Reed Timmer, thank you so much for taking time. I guess it's really before storm season really sets in, for coming into the KGOU studios today.
Yeah, and I think sometimes storm season will start early. Like last year, there was the big March 2nd outbreak in Kentucky. And then just a year ago, the other night, the night of the March 19th, we were southwest of San Antonio in a nighttime tornado that was heading straight for downtown. And thankfully, it weakened. San Antonio dodged the bullet. But sometimes they start early. 2006 is another example. But then those years, you know, it really quieted down in the plains, which is a good thing. Last year was the first May since 2005. There were zero fatalities, and it was an early start to the storm season. But I have a feeling it's going to be a late April into May type Southern Plains season this year. I think we'll get active again here.
You're famous or infamous, I guess it would depend, as a person who has really, really brought a national audience to this, the whole idea of storm chasing and finding tornadoes and looking at them and doing the research. Tell me about your newest project and how it's different from what we may have seen before from you on like the Discovery Channel and that kind of thing.
Yeah, we did the Discovery Channel show for 4 years, and that ended in 2011. And so we took the initiative to really grow up our online presence. We know that internet's eventually going to merge with television. It's kind of underway, and we're in this complex transitional period. So we decided to do our own independent production, Tornado Chasers, that can be viewed at tvnweather.com. And it's independently produced, but we still have the shooter, director of photography from Discovery Channel that rode the Dominator with us for all the intercepts. So it's still TV quality, but there's 12 episodes that we shot in 2012, and we put every resource we had into it. But I think it gave a more intimate look into the lives of storm chasers and the sacrifices that we make driving 80,000 miles a year, beyond the gas station meals every day that, you know, hurt the mental and physical health. But I think it shows kind of more realistically what we're trying to do out there. And said, whereas Discovery had three teams that you'd bounce back and forth between. It was action, action, action. And honestly, it made me look like a spaz. But I'm actually not like that all the time. I have my calm moments.
Yeah, because really watching the Discovery Channel series, that you're right, there is no pause.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it can be embarrassing to watch sometimes, honestly. You know, when you don't like to hear the sound of your own voice. Imagine watching that first episode when, you know, I'm freaking out and saying back up, and I'm hitting an octave that I never thought I could hit before. I mean, I was curled up in the fetal position watching it, pretty embarrassed, actually.
What other differences are there in having that production be under your control and direction versus working with the network?
Well, it's not necessarily under my control. So Ken Cole, who's an OU graduate, actually is the executive producer and editor of the new series. And he did Tornado Glory in 2003 for the University of Oklahoma here as his master's project, where he rode in our back seat and shot, edited, directed, produced everything. And so now everything's come full circle after Discovery, and Ken is heavily involved in our production side and also the business side now, and I'm actually about to meet him at the Sam Noble Museum for the Science Day. But when you work with a big network, there's a lot more restraints. It's a lot more constrictive. Like, you have to have a weather meeting every morning, for example, or talk about what's going to happen during the day, and there's more kind of where they attach kind of a schedule to the storm chasing, which is very difficult to attach a schedule to. So, you know, we'd have to wake up a lot earlier, and which is trouble, you know, hard for me because I'm more nocturnal. But I think that, you know, there's a lot more care of people to deal with. We had 2-3 vehicles behind us, some producers from New York, shooters from Los Angeles that had never seen storms like we get out here in the plains. And to coordinate with them and make sure they stayed, remained safe was a top priority too. So it's like you're this team though as well. So it was fun there for several years, but you know, I think it did get a little burned out toward the end, especially juggling finishing my PhD with doing the show and the speaking events in the off season.
I want to talk a little bit about kind of where you are in that process, and then also to address kind of the issue of the idea of television entertainment, which, you know, that's what television is, versus the science involved in what you do.
Well, yeah, I should defend this semester, actually the next month. So I'm working nonstop in my dissertation. I think it's approaching 400 pages now, and it's in seasonal climate prediction, actually, for agriculture. So you also have to do the physiology of the plants, how the farmers can change their farming strategies based on climate information, and so there's a lot to it. But kind of the merging of television and science is interesting, because the science that's depicted on television and what's enjoyable by the people that watch, they don't like to see the numbers and the equations and the, you know, the programs that we're writing in our computer to record the data, for example. They like to see the rocket probes get launched into the tornado, and that is exciting, and I love launching those probes into the tornado as well. And you're collecting data that other people can't safely collect when you're in an armored vehicle driving into a tornado, because the real mystery behind tornadoes is the wind speeds right near the ground. It's not above where it interacts with friction. And a lot of the mobile radar vehicles have to stay, you know, a standoff distance away from the tornado, and they scan higher up. And so they're missing that friction layer. And that's when you can get a tornado that can split into multiple vortices. And those individual suction vortices theoretically could pack winds of 400, 500, 600 miles per hour on the real small time scales. But it's impossible to measure them unless you have a device inside or you have a vehicle with armor. And you may have a little bit of a screw loose to get really close to the tornadoes and measure those wind speeds. And so, but the beauty of science is it's a collaborative effort. And you know, we're funding ours a lot out of our own pocket. I can tell you I'm not the kind of guy that saves up for retirement. We don't have grants just yet. But you know, I think that the merging of the private sector with science is something that's important. You have academia where you have grad students, and you have the theory and the computer programming, and you have big field projects like Vortex 2, and then you have the private sector where, you know, you can almost do whatever you want. And I think that that fringe kind of science also helps advance science as a whole and all working together. And for example, when we intercepted the tornado in Wyoming in 2009, when Vortex 2 was in the field, we provided all our data that we collected inside that tornado to Dr. Josh Werman for his research.
And Vortex 2, which was, you know, the object was to investigate this idea of tornado genesis, in other words, what is formed. And that's where we really kind of did come to this idea that that local micro pinpoint climate, what's happening on the ground at that point in time, really makes a difference, more so than I think we thought before. Is that accurate?
Yeah, and I think Vortex 2 a lot was trying to discriminate between the supercells that produced tornadoes and those that did, or the ones that produced tornadoes and those that didn't, based on the surrounding environment, near supercell environment. But the real mystery of tornadoes on that small scale are those suction vortices that spin around. And the fastest wind speeds inside a tornado theoretically happen right near the ground. And that's counterintuitive, because you'd think friction would slow down the wind, but that causes it to excite multiple vortices, and you get real intense winds on the small scale. And in that case, that's when you get one house that's completely destroyed, whereas the house next door is left untouched. And a better understanding of those complex dynamics is definitely necessary, because structural engineers can better design homes to withstand those types of winds. And we're measuring not only the horizontal winds, but also the vertical winds with our mobile radar on our armored vehicles. So when you watch the show on Discovery, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, well, where's all the data and everything? But that's where my presentations come in, when I go school to school and I'll show the data and we share it with whoever's interested in it. And when I was younger, I was always a science nerd. I was in Science Olympiad, and I was so excited to come to school because I thought it'd be this beautiful thing where everybody works together in this collaborative effort. But I actually realized there are more egos in academia than in the private sector, believe it or not. And it was actually the opposite. But there are advantages to both. I love academia and I love the private sector and how they fit together as well.
We talk about the science, and that obviously is important, but there's also intuition that comes into science, and I would guess especially into storm chasing. How has that developed in you? How have you developed that sense of when things are going to happen and having that idea that this is where I need to be at this particular point in time?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of science in pinpointing a target area, but once you get within that target area, actually finding the storms requires, I think, a lot of intuition and more so experience. And I'm a little OCD, I guess. I don't consider it a disorder, but all I look at is weather maps. I mean, forecast models. I look at all the previous setups that have happened. Every single time we chase, if we miss a tornado, I try to find out why. If a tornado happened and we didn't expect it, I try to find out why, and I'm constantly trying to learn, and there's so much more to learn. There's this perfect blend, I think, of using your eyes and visually being able to interpret the storms that are going to produce a tornado, and also kind of having that feeling, you know, how does this system compare to previous systems and how did it transpire differently based on what the models are showing. And so I think that field experience is very important. And the merger of that field experience, you know, with the scientists and the peer researchers or the peer mathematicians or the physicists that are involved in projects like Vortex 2, I think that's a beautiful project because you have people, storm chasers, that are working along with scientists that don't have a chance or want to get out in the field as much, are more interested in the theory. But the perfect science is where you need those real-world measurements to match it up with the theory because you don't know if the theory is accurate or those computer simulations are an accurate depiction of tornadoes unless you have the real observations to match it up with.
So what's the first tornado you saw?
It was in October 4, 1998, and I was a freshman at the University of Oklahoma, and it was just north of Oklahoma City up near Perry. And I remember looking east, and it was actually two little ones right next to each other. I'll never forget it. And one of the second or third or fourth tornadoes I saw was my spring of my freshman year, and that was the May 3rd, 1999 tornado. And I started storm chasing the wrong way. I just went out there and let it rip. There were five of us in a soft-top geo tracker. Really didn't know what we were doing. We had maps, you know, no cell phones back then. You had to use pay phones to try to get radar updates. But next thing we know, we're in the path of this F5, and it's coming at us. And I remember looking at it and seeing, I thought it was a radio tower or some huge debris flying around. But I never thought, you know, this thing could kill me. I was so mesmerized by its beauty. And tornadoes are beautiful scientifically, photogenically, but they have a dark side that they leave behind, and that's the damage. And we ran underneath an overpass. There were families panicking underneath. There was the tornado coming straight at us, and then it veered off to the left, and we were covered in mud, kept chasing it. Thankfully, you know, we didn't lose our lives. I mean, obviously, storm chasers never want to become the victim of a tornado. That's the last thing we want to have happen. But back then, I was naive. You know, I thought I knew what I was doing and didn't. And then we came across the damage and more and saw, you know, things that will stick with you forever. Mm-hmm. And it's that dark side and the damage that tornadoes leave behind that really motivates you that much further to go out there and call in the reports and help out in the warning process and collect as much data as you can to help out in the scientific process as well.
I know that as a journalist and a media person who's grew up in Oklahoma and been out in watching storms and not necessarily chasing but doing reports and things, that it is difficult sometimes to communicate to the general public that, you know, this is not a time when you should be getting on the road. But we see more and more of that. It seems like that as soon as there's a report of a tornado or a storm that people just pour out. How have you seen that change over the years in terms of the number of people who are chasing, for lack of a better term? Not all of them are professionals, of course.
Mm-hmm. Well, when I first started back in 99, there were hardly any people out. There were just very few people. So we were kind of in that era where it changed. You know, a twister was in about when I was graduating high school, and then that kind of increased the class sizes and there are more storm chasers. And now with greater technologies like an iPhone or, you know, a GPS unit or mobile internet, you know, anyone can storm chase. And but they don't realize how hard it is actually to find a tornado, how much gas money it costs, how many sacrifices you have to make. And so one thing I've noticed in storm chasing over 15 years is there'll be a group of storm chasers I hang out with. They'll get married or whatever, move on, you know, the next group.
They get the retirement plan that you don't have.
They'll get the normal life and then move on. But there are a lot of sacrifices made. I mean, I don't really have much of a personal life, don't get out much, but I love what I do for a living. And my mom always said, if you do what you love for a job, you'll never work a day again in your life. And she's partially right, but, you know, 60-70% of the time during the off season and everything else, it's a lot of work to try to maintain an entity that, you know, will at least, you know, break even. Usually a slow loss is acceptable, though.
Well, and when did you first have this realization or have the thought that I might actually be able to support myself and do this thing that really there aren't, I don't know if there's anybody else, let alone not too many anyway, who have been able to turn the passion around storm research and storm chasing into a livelihood?
Well, I think my first couple years of storm chasing, or first 2 years, I went back to Michigan and worked at a golf course over the summers where I'd mow fairways and everything, and it was a great job, but I would freak out every time I'd miss tornado outbreaks. But I realized that, you know, but I like getting up close to tornadoes. It's just something that I've always done. I'm more afraid of human beings and tornadoes, honestly, but in chasing, because I feel like, you know, tornadoes have to follow certain laws of fluid dynamics, and it's just something that I understand. I have a lot of phobias too, but tornadoes are not one of them in terms of storm chasing. Now, if one were to catch me by surprise in the middle of the night, you know, obviously I'd be very afraid. But I think the first time was when I started selling videos to the news networks, and we'd get, you know, $300-$400 here, there. And like when that came in, I was like, oh my gosh, you know, this could last me half a semester. And, you know, and then we gradually started selling more and more video. It was just me back then, to news networks and production companies. And then, I thought, you know, I got to find a way to mass produce DVDs. And so we started a website in 2003, to sell DVDs, and gradually it just grew and grew. And then in 2007, and there are some down periods in there too. Like in 2004, we rolled our car in a sewage ditch, and 2006 saw zero tornadoes, and so my credit card was maxed out quite a bit, and the bank account was zero. But I think that also helps you, you know, when you're doing a startup, you know, when you're used to kind of that bottom and scrapping and kind of getting through and barely making ends meet, you know, when things are going well, you appreciate it that much more. But also when things, you know, tumble down and don't go so well, you know, it's not that devastating, you know, because I mean, really, all you need is shelter, internet, and a vehicle to, to storm chase and have a great life, and enough money to pay for gas.
And cell phone bill.
Yeah, cell phone bill as well now, yeah, and all the data and everything. But yeah, we grew it and grew it, and then discovery happened, and then we launched a tour company, and then now we're focusing on the online space and live streaming video, which is another very useful tool for getting the word out and helping out with storm reporting. We're doing podcasts and the online series Tornado Chasers on TVNweather.com. And so we're basically taking all traditional forms of media and then putting them on the internet and focusing on severe weather. And that's kind of our future. But it grew so big. I mean, so out of control, honestly, during storm chasers. I mean, next thing I know, I go from driving a 1985 Plymouth Reliant to having these three armored vehicles with engineers and radars and cannon probes and three production follow vehicles. And it happened so fast that it's like the last 5 years were a time warp almost.
Yeah, I guess we could use the term tornadopreneur to describe your success in that.
I think, yeah, there was a success in them, but there was also 2012 was a rough year, but I think it was needed to kind of put things back into perspective, because after discovery, you know, we lost a lot of the revenue that came in that helped us support our research, and everything went into those armored vehicles and the radars and instrument probes. And but now, you know, we have a smaller organization, and it's kind of interesting because after the show was over, you know, I look around and there always used to be like 20 people around that a lot of times I didn't know. And I'm sitting in my house by myself working on my dissertation. I'm like, where'd everybody go? And then, but the people that are left behind, like the Ken Coles and Joel Taylor and all the our programmer, Seth, for example, they were all there before Storm Chasers. And I feel like we have a really good organization for growing in the online space, and then also completing my PhD this semester. It has to be this semester, so I've got a month to not knock it out, and I'm on the last chapter and doing revisions, and I'm almost there. So
I guess there wasn't much interest in Discovery Channel doing the dissertation, the final chapter, that TV series.
I would have let him be there for my defense, but yeah, the Discovery Channel wasn't as interested in the statistics behind seasonal climate prediction as much as I am. I get fired up in the middle of the night when I'm looking at it and you find some anomaly that's tied to a Pacific sea surface temperature pattern. But yeah, I'm a science nerd at heart and always have been. And but that's one thing we can cover with our independent series too, more is the science and kind of the result of our research and the work that we put into it. So
the way that you went about funding the new project, and you talked about how you're bringing together all this media and things, is you really went out to the people who have followed you and have supported you in the past, either through the TV show or in other ways. Tell me how that went.
Yeah. So 2012 is our first independent season that we shot. We shot 12 episodes and they're available on our website. And then we wanted to take it to the next level in 2013. And with technology rapidly changing, there's all kinds of new things you can get with, you know, the GoPro cameras you can mount in the exterior of the vehicle, and the audio systems and the cameras and the gas money. And there's a lot, you know, that goes into the production budget. So we used kind of an up-and-coming trend for independent projects and in Hollywood, as well as Kickstarter.com, and it's crowdsource funding. But it's not like a donation. They get rewards in return. And so basically, you know, some of those rewards, for example, are the free season pass for the 2013 season that the Kickstarter campaign is for. So it's almost like you believe in a project, you're paying for something in advance, And the more pledges that we get, you know, the higher quality it's going to be. And we surpassed our goal so far. Now we have stretch goals. We have another week to go, and hopefully we'll make it. So we're going to take it to the next level this year for sure. And no one will be let down. And now we're in a position to where when internet merges with television, we'll have a lot of online series content on our website.
How do you make good television out of something that basically is kind of the same story? I mean, the storm chaser story is you look at the weather, like you said, you anticipate where generally tornadoes might develop, and then you're in the field and you follow it and it happens or it doesn't happen, or you're, you know, on the right side or the wrong side. I mean, how do you keep that fresh over this period of time?
Well, I think that's a lot of what with Discovery, you know, it was more like that, where it was kind of all about the storm chasing and the storms more so, and the missions of each individual team, which can become repetitive. But with an independent series like this, you know, you kind of show the human struggle too to accomplish a goal and an ultimate mission. And we're not even close to accomplishing our ultimate mission. We want to have three dominators around the tornado with high resolution radar scanning the base of it to try to measure those suction vortices and launch parachute probes into the tornado and measure temperature, moisture, and pressure and just get a really comprehensive understanding of the tornado near the ground. And I felt like we never got a chance to accomplish our mission with Discovery. And I think that, you know, we still, it could be this season, it could be 10 years from now, but we're going to keep trying and keep struggling. And I think the human element, you know, and also trying to survive business-wise and paying the bills and all that kind of stuff. And with an independent production like this, you know, you can cover that. And we're not only going to cover tornadoes. We want to expand to hurricanes and do research inside the eye wall of strong hurricanes and measure those tornado-like vortices that could spin around and chase storms and typhoons in Asia, for example. And we went to Argentina back in 2009 and chased tornadoes there where they're flip-flopped on a north-south axis. So the tornado's on the north side instead of the south side. And so we can expand worldwide and do all kinds of series. And I think that there are no limitations when you're doing an independent production except for resources. But with the trends like Kickstarter, for example, and the crowdsource funding are a great way for people to accomplish their dreams and not have to depend on the big corporations.
Looking at the technology, and I know because you've made good use of that over the years, but what is out there? What do you see coming that might help not just you in the work you do, but also just in that tornado storm prediction process in general?
Well, I think that, like you said earlier, there's a lot more storm chasers out there. And that's not a bad thing, because in places like Dixie Alley further east, where the April 27, 2011 outbreak happened, and Tuscaloosa was hit, and Birmingham and Hackleburg, Alabama and Mississippi, Georgia, it stretched across several states. I mean, it was one of the biggest outbreaks in history, and the loss of life was extremely tragic. But you know, I think that having more storm chasers out there and more eyes in the field and providing that ground truth underneath the storm is also a good thing for having more storm chasers out there. The key is just that those storm chasers be trained and know what they're doing and don't do what I did and just go out there and let it rip and put your life at risk. And you should go with a veteran storm chaser or a tour company and learn what you're doing, and you can learn faster, and that's the way to do it. But I also think everybody seems to be working together more on the warning process side, too. You have the storm chasers, the spotters, the emergency managers, the National Weather Service, and news media, and they're all working together to increase those warning lead times. And they've been really dialed in. Even this winter, there's been over 100 preliminary tornado reports in the South U.S. since January 1st. And, for example, the Hattiesburg EF4 that went right through the center of town, there was no loss of life from that tornado, and there's substantial warning lead time. So the warnings are great, and there's also a social sciences aspect to it, and what makes a difference between a guy that wants to stand on his porch and drink a Bud Light and watch a tornado come right at him versus those that do the right thing and take shelter and are proactive and get an above-ground safe room or find out where those safe locations are. And there is a social sciences aspect to it too. But in terms of technology, social networking is a huge tool that has allowed us to get the word out really fast. And everybody uses this too to say, hey, there's a warning or a tornado warning headed for this location in Georgia. And then anybody on our social network that knows friends or family or anybody in that location will share it. And even if they don't, they'll share it. And because you never know if a friend of a friend of a friend might know somebody in that location. And it makes it really easy to spread the warning and spread severe weather information very fast and efficiently.
And I know that the National Weather Service and NOAA, they're looking at you know, how to use those tools so that they get the message out and get it across. You talked about driving through Moore, Oklahoma, and seeing that destruction after the May 3rd tornado. In your mind, what things did you think, I wish the people that went through this, I wish they would have had this before the storm hit. I wish they would have had to help in to help keep them safe.
Well, it depends on the tornado and the specific damage. Like in Yazoo City, Mississippi, we came across damage, and there's mobile homes everywhere, and you know, there's not much people can do when a tornado is bearing down on you except leave the mobile home or go in a ditch or know of a above ground safe shelter. But they didn't really have a safety plan in place. And Yazoo City is a place, it was a tornado that we chased. It was 2 miles wide in 2010, and we went house to house and pulled people out and saw injuries that, you know, will still always stick with you forever. And we bought them an above ground tornado shelter a couple years ago. And now they're recently, there's a tornado warning like right near Yazoo City, and they had 16 people in the shelter. And so that's a really fulfilling way of helping out. But I wish that those people had a shelter, for example. And on April 27th, I wish that people had more of a respect for tornadoes too, because when we were going through the damage, a lot of the people knew there were tornado warnings, but they just assumed it'd be a false alarm or would miss their location, and it didn't take the necessary precautions. And in Dixie Alley in the southeast especially, there are so many storms that exhibit rotation and could produce tornadoes that you get many more tornado warnings out there. But I think that, you know, good can come from bad, even in situations like this where the bad is so tragic, you know, and an April 27th outbreak, is that it causes people to respect tornadoes. And I think that 2011 and the videos that have been shared virally through YouTube and the social networks, people see the damage that they cause. And when a tornado warning is issued, you never know when somebody might see a video on YouTube of that tornado going through Tuscaloosa that might stick with them and make a difference between them taking the warning seriously and then ignoring it. And I'd say that the zero loss of life that EF4 in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, is probably a result of people more respecting tornadoes after the 2011 season.
Well, and the Joplin tornado, too, was an example of, I mean, I remember talking to professionals who had been in the field for a long time who really thought they would never see that level of loss of life again. And here it happened. And part of that was because people were out there, they didn't have a plan. So, you know, I want to hear the what does a re-timmer do when you're not in a dominator, and if you were faced with that decision, you're shopping at the big box store and you hear sirens or your cell phone goes off and you have an alert that there's a tornado warning, what would you do?
Well, first of all, I'd be proactive. If I had a family and was at home, I'd have a above ground safe shelter if I could afford it. If not, I'd have some type of below ground tornado shelter. And I would also know all the locations of the nearby safe rooms in case a tornado warning is issued. I'd talk to people and have a safety plan in place. I'd always have a NOAA weather radio that is charged with batteries. Make sure the batteries are always charged. It has an alarm, so you're always aware of the warnings well in advance. If I'm on the road and a tornado warning is issued, just try to find the nearest shelter, and just kind of knowing that your general area and your surroundings and knowing where those sturdy, you know, safe rooms are located. Even getting in like the freezer of a gas station, for example, if you know the tornado is coming and have sufficient warning lead time, you can make it happen. One thing you shouldn't do is try to outrun the tornado, because if everybody tries to do that, you're going to have a traffic jam, and that's the worst case scenario. But an interior room or closet is definitely something that would work if you can't find, you know, an above ground tornado shelter or basement. And in the worst case scenario, getting a ditch or culvert, lowest area, even those like little drainage pipes, you know, they're on the ground. You get in there during the tornado, but you shouldn't try to outrun it. But one thing is that if you're on the road and a tornado is not moving side to side, it's either coming right at you or moving away or stationary. And you probably want to assume it's moving toward you. I mean, with a tornado warning, you always want to assume the worst case scenario. But what you want is to have the tornado far away, obviously, and moving across your field of view. And if it's doing that, then and you feel comfortable and you're far away and it's moving across your field of view, then stay put and don't try to move.
Don't try to move. You shared quite a few stories, and especially those about, you know, seeing what happens after a tornado hits a populated area. I've seen those kind of things too, and they do stick with you. What's one of the stories, one of the storm chases that really you think exemplifies the best of your work?
I would say it was probably in June 17, 2009 in southern Nebraska, and it was the Dominator 1. Those are our armored vehicles. There's Dominator 1, 2, and we're building a third one this year that has gull wing doors like Back to the Future, and it's built on a bigger vehicle, can withstand stronger tornadoes, and has new research instruments, as well as like a holding area in the back for first responder type stuff. If we do have someone with first responder training with us, then they could use those tools and help out. But I'd say that June 17, 2009 in Dominator 1 was because, you know, we were trying to measure the vertical winds and horizontal winds inside suction vortices. And the worst case scenario happened for us. It was good for, you know, the data that we collected, but the tornado intensified with us inside. And it was a seemingly weak tornado. And I didn't have time to lift up our bulletproof Lexan windows, where we'd manually lift them up and latch back then. And so I just rolled up the regular glass window, and it intensified, and our ears were popping from the pressure fall. The whole vehicle was shaking back and forth. The radar engineer in the back seat, our camera operator, was like, "Mick, your ear's bleeding." And he had a little stream of blood coming out of his ear, and that was from that pressure fall that ruptured his eardrum. And he went to the doctor later, and they said that they see that a lot in pilots flying it, you know, with significant altitude changes. But a suction vortex, and that's the we're trying to measure the wind speed inside those, actually ironically developed in the backside of the tornado and blew the window out into my face. And there's a bunch of tiny cuts, and it looked, you know, a lot worse than it was. But the data that we collected was really good because it showed the wind speed overall in a weak tornado was 70 to 90 mile per hour winds. But then when that suction vortex hit, in less than a second, the winds ramped up to 138.8 mile per hour winds. And we were also measuring the vertical winds inside the tornado at the same time. And it's not only the horizontally rotating winds that cause damage, but also those updrafts. It's almost like a vacuum cleaner in some cases with a tornado. And the winds can be very complex near the ground. And that was an example of a tornado where, you know, I thought we were in trouble, honestly. But in the end, it was a really rewarding to be able to collect data inside it. And even better, the tornado was in the middle of nowhere and didn't hurt anybody.
So finally, any predictions for 2013 and what we might expect in terms of a storm season? We've got the drought that's kind of still lingering. Some people saying that it may have some effect.
Yeah, it's hard to tell, you know. Correlation definitely doesn't, you know, infer causation, I think. And I think that it's going to be an active season in the southern plains extending east across Dixie Alley, and you're going to have these high amplitude troughs. And based on my work with seasonal climate prediction using the Pacific Sea Service temperature patterns, in addition to El Nino, the North Pacific is also important. And all those are indicating toward getting more rain in the central and southern plains. But when you get more rain here in Tornado Alley, it usually means tornadoes and big time hail. And hopefully the storm outbreaks aren't significant in Dixie Alley as those big storm systems translate east. But whatever happens, happens, and we'll be out there chasing it, doing our best to try to get the word out.
Reed Timmer, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.